a short four-year committee on rural development, and to everybody in this august house, let me start by saying that the commissioner who prepared this report and my fellow commissioner, Ms. Janet Love, and unfortunately she fell ill and could not be here today, but she then asked me to represent her on behalf of the Human Rights Commission to present this report today. I have given copies of this report, the hard copies of this report. I hope they are enough, but if they aren't, then we will get the balance to your office in due course. We've also prepared a PowerPoint presentation on the matter and we'll talk through the issue itself. And thank you very much. My name is Shafiq Amir Mia. I'm one of the full-time commissioners in the South African Human Rights Commission, dealing with socio-economic rights as well, right to housing, access to justice as well. Those are my mandates, but in relation to this, I'm going to speak to this document through the investigative report that was commissioned by the South African Human Rights Commission in terms of the Human Rights Commission Act last year, November 3rd and November 2013 and 1st December 2013. And the findings of this report are all captured here, and then we'll talk about the issues here. Without belaboring issues here, let me just go and say that by way of introduction and background, I'd like to say that land ownership in South Africa has long been a source of conflict. Its history of conquest and dispossession, of forced removal, and a racially skewed distribution has left it with a complex and difficult legacy. So the Restitution of Land Rights Act, which we've called the Restitution Act, was passed in 1994 at the advent of the democratic rule in South Africa, and was amended at the end of 1998. One of its objectives, it states, is that to provide for restitution of rights in land in respect of which persons or communities were dispossessed under or for the purpose of furthering the object of any racially based discriminatory law. So in an investigation of the South African Human Rights Commission last December, November and December, there were five respondents that basically responded to our hearing. It was the Department of Land Reform, Rural Development and Land Reform, the Department of Public Works, the Commission on the Restitution of Land Rights, the Chief Surveyor General, and the Land Management Facility. So those are the five respondents that basically came to the investigative hearing. Having said that by way of introduction, I'd like to then talk about the summary of the proceedings and have to say to you that the South African Human Rights Commission receives complaints and queries relating to land restitution and the broader Section 25 rights. The issue of the 1998 deadline identified as a concern, but there were also other challenges that have made resolution of existing claims difficult and or severely delayed. The view of the South African Human Rights Commission acknowledges, besides redress and accountability issues, land restitution process is also aimed at progressive realization of socio-economic rights. And I want us to flag this issue because I will talk to this issue in relation to the international covenant on socio-economic rights as well and the impact it's going to have on the act itself. The South African Human Rights Commission acknowledges process has moved very slowly with regard to existing land claims and remains beset by challenges that shadow desired effects of equitable redress and socio-economic empowerment. Given the above, and in the interest of the South African Human Rights Commission's ability to fulfill its mandate, there was a need for a holistic view of these challenges to be attained. Sorry, I just lost my brain off. convene investigative hearing in terms of Section 91C of the Human Rights Commission Act 54 of 1994 on the systemic challenges affecting the land restitution process in South Africa. So although the issue of exclusion of claims that came about through the 1998 Northland cutoff is one of the matters raised by the South African Human Rights Commission that may be addressed through the Restitution of Land Rights Amendment Act, which was passed in February 2014, this issue was not intended to form the central part of the investigative hearing. Instead, the hearing aims to obtain a better understanding of why existing claims remain unresolved nearly two decades after the Act became law. However, a number of submissions did center on potential implications of the reopening of the claims lodgement process. The decision by the President to reopen the land claim for a further 5 years from 30th June 2014 to 30th June 2019 constitutes, in our view, an important step to enable people who are unable or inadequately prepared to present their claims prior to the 1998 deadline for submission. However, the Commission is of the view that in order to address and remedy the land restitution process in South Africa, it is necessary to deal with the challenges identified over the past 20 years and not to depend on legislative changes that fail to address issues that have been identified as needing to be remedied. Now, just to give you some background on the summary of the proceedings, it was by way of an inquisitorial hearing. A hearing requesting the National Department and other parties having a direct relationship to the state implementation of the land restitution process make submissions to the Human Rights Commission. These include the departments mandated to initiate and implement South Africa's integrated rural development program, provide equitable redress to victims of racially motivated land dispossession, resolve restitution claims, and provide post-settlement support. Parties were also requested to present documentation to assist the South African Human Rights Commission to establish the extent of the challenges relating to the land restitution process. In part, the decision by certain parties to focus on the then restitution of Land Rights Amendment Bill, Land Rights Amendment Bill, now the Act 15 of 2014, enabled the panel to make findings that related to whether the proposed amendment would address current challenges and shortcomings. The submissions requested from the parties were set out on the issues for discussion. These included requests for data on the following: the mandate of the relevant body and its role in terms of land restitution, the challenges experienced by that body in relation to land restitution, the steps taken to address such challenges, and how the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform, which I'll call for a short analysis, the Department of Land Reform, relates to the Commission for Restitution of Land Rights. And that's why I'm saying I'm going to refer to the Department and the Commission so we must have an understanding of the two stakeholders that we're talking about in terms of monetary compensation awarded for land restitution, the number of finalized claims that involve compensation, and the number that involved land being returned. The manner in which the Commission for Restitution deals with a situation when a claim is under review, that is, on a piece of land that is being disposed of for other development. The number of claims that are on state land. Now, the legal framework in land reform and land restitution is underpinned by Section 25 of the Constitution, the white paper on the South African land policy, and restitution of land rights 22 of 1994 as amended at the end of 1998, the restitution of land rights amendment Act 15 of 2014, which reopened the lodgement period to 30th of June 2019. The legal framework, then I go to the legal framework, Madam Chair, that underpins this entire process and land reform and land restitution. In terms of Article 7 of the Universal Declaration In terms of Article 7 of the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights drops a reference to property rights. The intention of the International Covenant on Economic and Social Rights is to ensure protection of economic, social and cultural rights to citizens of member states. The United Nations Declaration more specific to land includes the Declaration on Social Progress, 1969, which recognizes the social function of property, including land, and calls for form of land ownership that ensures equal rights to property for all. United Nations specialized agencies, food and agriculture organizations, and the International Labour Organization have given most attention to land rights issues in either binding conventions or non-binding declarations. The ILO's Indigenous and Tribal Peoples Convention No. 169 of 1989 is a key instrument in the evolution of concepts of land rights in international law. The first protocol on the European Convention on Human Rights states, no one shall be deprived of his possession except in the public interest and subject to conditions provided for by law and by general principles of international law. Article 21 of the American Convention on Human Rights states, everyone has the right to use and enjoyment of his property. The law may subordinate such use and enjoyment to the interests of society. No one shall be deprived of his property except upon payment of just compensation for reasons of public utility or social interest, and in the cases and according to the form of established law. And then we move on to the regional covenant. We're looking at Article 14 of the African Charter on Human and People's Rights that guarantees the right to property. Article 21 states, all people shall freely dispose of their wealth and natural resources. This right shall be exercised in the exclusive interest of the people. In no case shall the people be deprived of it. In case of spoliation in dispossessed people, in case of spoliation, the dispossessed people shall have the right to lawful recovery of its property as well as an adequate compensation. These provisions apply to ownership of land as well as security of tenure of land. Now, the synopsis we got from our report then, we come to the South African case law on the issues. And I have picked up on page 19 of the report that you have in front of you, Chair, the following cases. The one is the Richtersveld and others, with the Alexco Limited and another, which came before the Land Commission in Land Claims Court in 2001, and in August 2001, the Transport Community in Makado, the Bapiri and others, also in Land Claims Court case 1998, and the Sophia Town matter. My apologies. So, we are saying that the salient features of the Richtersveld community is the following, and it's clearly stated in the document on page 19. The Richtersveld community brought a claim for restoration of its ancestral land in terms of the restitution of Land Rights Act. The important aspect of the case was the community's assertion that it used the land according to its indigenous customs. In the Supreme Court of Appeal view, the undisputed fact of this case shows that the Richtersveld community, living in the margin of history on the edge of the country, was largely ignored by successive governments, although these governments always recognized that the community had some kind of exclusive entitlement to the land. In the result, they were left in undisturbed possession of the land, which was never taken from them for settling colonists. The court's principal findings were, and there were five of them, that I thought was important for us to just reflect on. The Richtersveld community was in exclusive dispossession of the whole of the Richtersveld, including the subject land, prior to the annexation by the British Crown in 1847. The Richtersveld community rights to land, including precious stones and minerals, were akin to those under the common law ownership. These rights constituted a customary law interest and consequently a land, a right in land as defined in the Act. These rights survived the annexation of the land claims court. These rights survived the annexation, and the land claims court erred in finding that the community had lost its rights because it was insufficiently civilized to be recognized. When diamonds were discovered on the subject land during the 1920s, the state ignored the Richtersveld community's rights and dispossessed the Richtersveld community of its rights in the land in a series of steps amounting to practices as defined in the Act, culminating in the grant of full ownership of the land to Alex Cole, the mining house. These practices were racially discriminatory because they were based upon false or the unexpressed semi-state. Because of the...
Can I request our guest to be present? Because if there is unnecessary movement, you have to say the meeting.
Thank you, Minister. I go back to the first principle of this case here. These practices are racially discriminatory because they were based upon the fault or the unexpected famous death. Because of the Richtersveld community's race and lack of civilization, they had lost all rights in the land upon annexation. The result of these findings was that the Richtersveld community was entitled to restitution of the subject land, and the appeal then succeeded. Now, in defining the determining what is entailed by the customary law ownership of land, the Supreme Court of Appeal equated it with a common law ownership, while the Constitutional Court found.
As what it is, section 19 of the
of the main report, which is a substantive report, and basically what I'm saying there in this, the principle there is that the Supreme Court of Appeal equated it with common law ownership, while the Constitutional Court found that its content should be ascertained by studying the customs and uses of the community. And then I go further down there in this report. The court reasoning shows, and this is the crux of the matter, how the redefinition of the sources of South African property law affects the protection offered to relations with land. And then on page 20, we talked about the transport community, and there basically it was in the Limpopo province, the transport community made a claim that it was dispossessed under the land. Dispossessed of land under racially discriminatory law or practice. The community lived on a Dutch Reformed Church mission station at the foot of the Stoutlandsweg in Limpopo from 1890 until they were removed between 1955 and 1964. The community applied for restitution of their rights under the Restitution Act. The Dutch Reformed Church of then Transvaal opposed the claim. The church claimed there was no community either at the time of the removal or at the time of the claim that the claim was lost. And even if a community existed, it did not have any rights in the land. Even if the community provided proved its claim, they should not receive restoration of the farm, but rather some other award such as compensation. It was not feasible to restore the land because the community could not viably re-establish themselves there. The area was environmentally sensitive, and the restoration order would be bad for the environment. But the land claims court decided otherwise. The evidence proved that there was a community at the time of the removal and at the time of when the claim was lodged. The community had beneficial occupation of the farm for at least 10 years before the removal. The removals were a result of racially discriminating laws or practice, as the Group Areas Act was used to remove the people, and the removals were carried out in a racist manner. the group had not received compensation because any compensation given was not just and equitable as directed by the Act. Restoring the land to the community would therefore be just and equitable and allow upgrading of the beneficial occupation of full ownership. But the rider there was the court imposed conditions that the community had to fulfill before they could be, before they could get restoration of the land. And these were the formation by the community of a communal property association to hold the property, the approval by the court of a draft constitution of the CPA, the Community Property Association, confirmation by the CPA that it was restoration of the land and not some other form of compensation, the formulation of plans for the development and use of the property. The community had to meet these conditions within a fixed time limit or the court order would fall away. Then the community would be able to get a different type of compensation. On the issue of defining community as envisaged in the Restitution Act, the court made inference to the effect that the community must exist at two different levels. At the time of dispossession, it must be shown that there were shared rules which determined access to land, which was held in common by such a community. Examples in this regard may be to include the existence of a chief and his counselors. At the time when the claim was lodged, this can be the same community or part of a community that was dispossessed of rights in land. It does not have to be the identical community in that changes in the constituent family. The admission of new members and the departure of other members means that the face of a community changes over time. And then I come to the other issue of the Buffering case, but in the Buffering case, the court ruled that the plaintiff in that matter as part of a community is entitled to claim restitution of the right to land dispossessed from the full community, that is the Buffering tribe. And the plaintiff does not, however, act on behalf of the full community as it is not representative of the majority of the tribe. But I think what is very important, a very high profile case that came afterwards, and that is the Sophia Time matter, and that although it was settled administratively, there were very important principles that played itself out there. As I said, although the case was settled administratively, the former residents of the individual title holders of Sophia Town or their direct descendants lodged claim for individual properties of the former township of Sophia Town in the Gauteng province. These urban claims were for financial compensation for the loss of freehold titles. Sophia Town was renamed Troyes Triumph by the apartheid state and fought within the Northern Metropolitan Local Council of Johannesburg. The history of acquisition and dispossession of land rights that gave rise to Sophia Town restitution claims is widely known and has been extensively researched and documented. And I emphasize the extensive research and documentation. As I speak to the slide, you'll see why it becomes so important in our investigative findings later on that chair. So several pieces of legislation that worked around the dispossession of the people of Sophia Town. It was the Native Urban Areas Act of 1923, the Western Areas Removal Scheme of 1944, the Native Resettlement Act of 1954, the Group Areas Act of 1955. This act essentially declared that the whole municipal area of Johannesburg to be an area within which applicants, except those exempted, could not reside elsewhere than in locations, native villages and native hostels. The western area, including Sophia Town, happened to be the only place that offered viable alternative accommodation for natives removed from the inner city area in terms of this legislation. The implementation of the Native Urban Areas Act also preempted the influx of Africans to Sophia Town. Although the Act was in operation, its enforcement was not always consistent. Africans were still able to buy land within the white town. Sophia Town, Martin Bay and New Clay were the only townships within the white town, the municipal boundaries of Johannesburg, where it was possible for Africans to hold freehold title. The war policy entailed the removal of Africans from Sophia Town, Martindale and New Clay following political pressure from white ratepayers and voters. These people were resettled in Orlando and Fernville in Soweto. The team also made provision for the rescheduling of Safari Town as a white township. And then we go to the Group Areas Act of 41 of 1950. And the Group Areas Development Act were invoked to effect actual removals of Africans from Safari Town. These forced removals occurred between 1955 and 1960. The removals persisted despite the pressure from African property owners in the form of protests and resistance campaigns. Safari Town was renamed Freehomp within 5 years of the last removal. At the time of the removals, the government gave assurance that it would take steps, if necessary, to ensure that the African property owners were fairly compensated. Property owners in Safari Town and surrounding areas suffered from the negative effects of apartheid laws. The group areas on the value of their properties, that is, properties were being valued by people with no formal qualifications in property valuation. No negotiation seemed to have ever taken place. Safari Town restitution claimants did not receive just and equitable compensation. On page 22 of the main report, in dealing with this case, the Commission for Restitution on Land Rights had several challenges, especially around determining the monetary value of the claim. The record of valuations conducted in Safari Town at the time of dispossession could not be traced. This meant that vital information required for a historical valuation exercise could not be found, and the Commission then proposed an alternative approach that would not require a historical valuation exercise, but current valuation of a vacant service site from the area where claimants were removed. This methodology came to be called service site approach, which was then approved by the then Minister of Land Affairs as the approved policy. Those claimants who lost more than one property, and this is important for us to know, those claimants who lost more than one property got financial compensation equal to the number of properties they had lost. It is very important to understand the principle. About 540 claims were lost for the 1,001 property. This meant that just fewer than half the people had lost more than one property. The Northern Metropolitan Local Council took a unanimous decision to rename Freehomp back to Safari Town, its original name, by which it was commonly known in South Africa prior to the removal. Now, Madam Chair, these are the reported cases that I have picked up. But I want to say the principles that I've spoken to around these four cases, also goes across in the same vein, right, to the Khoi and the Sun, the land claim in the Western case, the District 6 land claim in the Western case, yet unresolved. The Molambiani claim in the Valley District, yet unresolved. The Manenje claim, which is a big claim in the Limpopo province, yet unresolved. The Masembe claim in the Giani Mojadis group also has challenges. Now, the reason why I make reference to these cases is that although in the certification of the Constitution, the President of the Constitutional Court, Justice Shackleton, said the realization of progressive socio-economic rights is as equal as civil and political rights. What I'm saying is you cannot give landless people socio-economic rights if they do not have land. And therefore you cannot even talk about progressive realization of those rights because there are no rights existing. And this is what we need to be understanding very clearly. I must emphasize, Chair, that there was a reason why I actually halted to talk about the South African case law, so that we have an appreciation that in future when the Land Claims Commission does decide to, I mean, it is a mandate to give effect to the Act itself, they must put these principles, they must understand and analyze the problems within the context of these cases. Now, going forward, Shepherd, Madam Chair, we called upon the respondents that you mentioned early on, and there was oral and written submission that were received from the representatives of the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform, the Commission for Restitution of Land Rights, the Department of Public Works, the Chief Surveyor General, the Land Rights Management Facility. The South African Human Rights Commission also sought the input of the Land Claims Court, and Acting Judge President Yasmin Lees participated in the hearing and contributed to the issues for discussion. And if I may take the committee, with your permission, Madam Chair, to page 41 and 42, under paragraph 7.6, I think it is important for us to note what she has to say about her input, and I really want us to reflect on these issues as well. And it says here, the South African, under paragraph 7.6, the South African Human Rights Commission heard the views of Acting Judge President Yasmin Meer of the Land Claims Court during the investigative hearing on the perception of a more favored approach by the state of financial compensation as opposed to restoration of land being the most preferred resolution when it comes to land for mining. The South African Human Rights Commission inquired as to whether the Land Claims Court had engaged with this. The Land Claims Court submitted that it engages with these issues in relation to orders. In granting an order, the Land Claims Court has to consider if there is a claim for physical restoration of land and whether or not such a claim is feasible. It is not the place of the Land Claims Court to advise claimants to go for money instead of restoration of land. The Land Claims Court receives proposals from the Commission and or from the claimants themselves. If there is a claim for restoration, for example, for the Bahatla case, where communities were dispossessed of land, which is currently the home of the South African National Defence Force, the Land Claims Court will weigh up the views of the opposing parties. The communities in Bakatla were passionate about that land. However, that land was dangerous and had landmines on it. In that circumstances, restoration did not happen. The Land Claims Court has needed to consider whether a national asset should be restored. Another example is that of the Cavendish Square in Cape Town, where a Carrick family who owned a tiny cottage that had existed on Cavendish Square. Where a Carrick community who owned a tiny cottage that had existed on the land wanted restoration of this land. However, during dispossession, that family did not lose Cavendish Square, they lost something different. This case was financially settled and the trial did not run. The Land Claims Court explained that when costing financial compensation, it is not always necessary money that is awarded instead of land. The Restitution Act allows the court to order restoration of state-owned land as an alternative when the land from which the individual or community was originally disposed is not feasible to be restored. The calculation of the value of land is currently under review in the court. In the Florence matter, the Land Claims Court used the Consumer Price Index to adjust what it viewed as a price for the land at the time of dispossession to the current market value. One of the requirements for compensation is that the claimant should get paid a reasonable and fair amount for the land. With regard to fair price for land on which mining rights have been awarded, the Human Rights Commission inquired as to the calculation of fair price. The Land Claims Court submitted that in every case, it has to find a balance calculating both market price and market value in the current economic climate. The LRCC needs to consider what was lost and what is there now. The Restitution Act provides for the Land Claims Court to take all these factors into account. It obtains valuations and then decides what the best form and amount of compensation ought to be. The Land Claims Court admitted that these types of land restitution cases are long and complex. And you see in our presentation later on the other problems that the investigative report found that speaks to these issues as well. The Department of Rural Development and Land Reform has submitted that one of its major challenges is the high number of cases that need to be resolved by and remain before the Land Claims Court. When consulted, the Land Claims Court explained that the primary issue is not that there is only one permanent judge, as this was not what delays judgment. The Land Claims Court case management system with a small team is in place and is efficient. However, the Land Claims Court is a circuit court, and legal practitioners should know that they ought not to summon the court unless all aspects of the case are ready for trial. Unfortunately, there are a number of matters that reach the court without all the necessary preparation. These are premature referrals, incorrect gazetting, incorrect categorization of claims, i.e. a community and not an individual claim, or financial compensation versus restitution. The backlog is general at the Commission for the CRLR. There may be a claim which the Commission on Restitution of Land Rights has certified that cannot be settled, but the necessary preparation has not been finalized to enable the matter to come to court. Consequently, there are also applications to compel the Commission on the Restitution of Land Rights to bring the cases to court. Once ordered, the Commission for the Restitution of Land Rights sometimes does not respond, and the Land Claims Court follows up with a phone call, drawing to the attention of the Commission the need for compliance with the court order. Thereafter, there are challenges regarding preparation of the client, the research that needs to go into every investigation, and cases are poorly put together without adequate preparation. I thought it was important for us to bring that to the attention. You will go to the report in your own time when you're discussing it in your committee. But we thought it was important for you to bring that to bring that to your attention. So the composition of the hearing panel consisted of my two colleagues, Commissioners Janet Love, who was the chairperson of the panel, and Commissioner Lindiwe Mokati, with Advocate Patrick Mosalana, who was one of the panel attendees. And our terms of reference were to receive information and to hear evidence from the respondents and other relevant parties relating to the systemic challenges affecting the land restitution process in South Africa, to analyze evidence brought before the panel, to make appropriate findings, to enable the Commission to make recommendations. And the procedure of the South African Human Rights Commission hearing was that the respondents were obliged to make written submissions as well as oral presentations. Each respondent had 1 hour to address the issues for discussion. The panel could then pose a series of questions, seek clarity for further information arising from the submission. And before making submissions, respondents were invited to take the oath or affirmation in the manner of their choosing. Now, there were several findings. There were 9 findings that I'm going to talk about, but it's all in the report. So, but I thought we have to highlight these issues here, given the moment that we had here before this August House. The hearings revealed that a number of challenges related to addressing the challenges affecting land restitution in South Africa include understaffing, lack of technical skills, inadequate research capacity. The investigative hearings also revealed that while there is some understanding by all of the respondents in land restitution matters of their role and responsibilities, guided by the core mandate, the role of the Commission of the Restitution of Land Rights is far less clear. The South African Human Rights Commission is concerned that systemic challenges affecting the land restitution process may be partly as a result of the current setup and subsequent understanding of the Commission of Restitution of Land Rights relationship with the Department of Rural Development. The Department of Rural Development and Land Reform submitted that the Commission for Restitution is one of its branches or units. And the Department of Rural Development deferred a number of questions posed to it by the South African Commission to the Commission for Restitution on Land Rights, explaining that the Commission for restitution for land rights would be a better place to address such a question, given that it was a unit in the Department of Rural Development. Now, this is a concern for the Human Rights Commission, as it suggests that the CRL, the Commission, will not construct its work in a manner that is impartial to and independent of the Department of Rural Development and Land Affairs. As in my opening introductory remark, where I said that one of the purposes behind the Act itself was to provide for the restitution of land rights in respect of which persons or communities were dispossessed under law, dispossessed under or for purpose furthering the object of any racially based discriminatory law. But that in the interim constitution, I must bring to your attention, this commission was independent, it was impartial, and it had those kind of things. So what I'm saying, if you can't be the soccer player and the referee in the same game, you're not going to make you're not going to come to appropriate resolutions of matters. So perhaps this needs to be revisited as well. The Department of Rural Development and Land Reform and the Commission for Restitution of Land Rights identified four research methodology that informed land claims. While the Commission for Restitution on Land Rights acknowledged difficulties with regard to how the existing claims have been recorded and captured in a number of different ways over time and problems that have occurred as a result of documents and files being lost, there was no indication of how the Commission for Restitution on Land Rights intends to deal with these problems. The issues of the losses that communities face from the exclusion from the benefits of the mineral resources in and under their land, which have also rendered their surface rights to the land impossible, is also something that needs to be more clearly addressed. It does not seem right that geographic dispossession results today in a perpetuation of wealth exclusion in a democratic South Africa. To that extent, the characterization of the restitution process by the Commission of Restitution of Land Rights submitted during the investigative hearing as a political problem has validity. However, the restitution process is also a judicial one and cannot be contingent on departmental policies that undermine the need for just and equitable and remedy of the past rights violations as envisioned in the Constitution. I want us please to reflect on this particular bullet because it has very important implications for restoring the rights of people who have been disadvantaged because of the racially inequitable laws of the past. We then also found that the backlogs of unresolved restitution claims raises concerns that claims filed under the new restitution period might further undermine the fulfillment of existing rights. Significant challenges in relation to the calculation and determination of the value of land from which individuals and communities were historically dispossessed, but which today have been seen in the context of subsequent development and uses. The Human Rights Commission is concerned at the absence of capacity with the Chief Surveyor General to do historical research, and if there is a proposal to recommend resettlement to provide a proper survey of the land and complete register of all land owned by different spheres of government and parastatals throughout the department and community develop plans for the future, given the fact that this comes 2 decades into our democracy. The Human Rights Commission is also concerned about the fact that the cadastral surveys of millions of hectares of land have not been undertaken, and the plans and resources necessary for this do not appear to be in place. Subdivisions and title deeds have not been finalized and registered, and this is particularly relevant in cases when the same land is subject to competing claims, a phenomenon that the South African Human Rights Commission believes will increase now that the lodgement of claims have been reopened. Another finding from the Human Rights Commission was that the Commission understands that the Commission for Restitution of Land Rights is tasked with facilitating the policies of the state in relation to restitution, acting first to secure the interests of those whose lives were uprooted and destroyed through the discriminated regimes of colonialism and apartheid. It is the Commission's view that these interests will not at all times be at the same, as the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform. And that is concerned that in the current setup, that is unclear, and that the Commission for Restitution on Land Rights refers to the Department of Rural Development priority in relation to the settlement of claims and the post-settlement arrangements, which the Commission for Restitution on Land Rights ought to confirm and ensure that there are arrangements in place to support prior to the finalization of the settlement. The Commission, the other finding is that the Commission remains concerned that these systemic challenges and gaps remain unresolved, and that although the number of outstanding claims is not reliable as the system of counting has changed over a period of time so often, thousands of people have been waiting for almost 2 decades to have their matters dealt with. Some documents appear to have been lost, and there is also no clarity on how the existing claimants will not be prejudiced by legislative amendments. The other finding was, although not a key focus area of our investigative hearing, the Human Rights Commission has concerns with the Land Restitution Amendment Act 15 of 2014 as it relates to existing claims. The additional period for submission of claims may create a possible resurgence of new land claims, and that is obvious. With the Department of Rural Development expecting approximately 397,000 claims, the backlog of unresolved restitution claims raises concern that claims filed under the new restitution period might further undermine the fulfillment of existing claims, even those that are already approved, but where the land titles and development monies have not yet been handed over. The Act will also open the space for claims, for example, by traditional leaders, which may be in conflict with existing claims by other community constituted structures. In addition, the Act intends to ban communal property institutions from only redistributed land. This removes an option to existing claimants without their concurrence. And in our concluding remarks, we basically then say, after having detailed our findings, we are saying that the Human Rights Commission is satisfied that the formalities prescribed in Article 26.1.3 of the South African Human Rights Commission Complaints and Handling Procedure have been complied with. It is a sincere hope of the Commission that this investigation and its findings will be of assistance in resolving some of the systemic challenges affecting land restitution process in South Africa. And we want to bring it to the attention of the House that we need to explore ways of how to engage this process in a constructive way, because the Commission will follow up with all parties in respect of whom recommendations were made to facilitate their implementation. Now, in our report, Chairperson, in the main report here, it's detailed about how, especially from page 24 to page 42, there were ways in which we were given the models of how, the Department of Rural, the department wished to, how they've identified the problems and how they saw the problems, how they wish to attend to these problems. But that is for another day. But to say that this is a comprehensive report from our side, Chairperson, I want to thank you personally and the Oblast House, members of the Portfolio Committee, and everybody else who took part in our investigative hearing for their contribution. And I'm sure with our cooperation, we will find those lasting solutions that the Constitution in Section 25 demands of us. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Advocate Mohammed. Members who have been listening, this is our opportunity to ask questions, comments on the report, the findings of the investigation that has been done by the South African Human Rights Commission. Honorable Waters, your hands are up. Honorable Ma, that's Honorable
be mulling over long after this meeting. But one of the, and I would like to get your perspective, if I can make a statement, what your perspective of it is. Would you say in land reform in South Africa there's a conflation between restitution, which certainly in my mind is a legal process that deals with justice, which deals with restoring that restoring that which was taken away, redistribution of land and a tenure reform. Some of your comments about the remarks made by the department in regards to food security suggest to me that there might be a conflation. I would like to get your opinion on that. Secondly, I find that the issue of value determination and absence of a starting point and a clear starting point and a clear end point for a restitution process where the guidelines, I find that interesting. Would you, is it a fragmented system you're dealing with? Do you have any particular suggestions in that regard? Is it something that one can deal with a turnaround time, for example? Would it be sensible and possible in a legal framework like a restitution is? And then I also wanted, there's two comments that come out of the report here, out of the body of the report. The one is that you don't see the problem being the legal and constitutional framework you got for a case of implementation. Did I read that correctly? Do you believe? Because obviously one of the issues in land reform that we constantly hear about is the problem is the constitution. I happen to disagree with it, but would you say this report bears up the point of view that it's implementation that rather than the legal framework that's the problem? And would you suggest, also what I see within this report, this property rights where you have full control over the property and the economic decision making around it should be an objective of the restitution process. Would that be correct if I say that's the general thrust of this report? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson, and also thank you to the Commissioner for your presentation. Commissioner, for you to enter the Constitution of Land Rights Amendment 84X, it is said that instead of the hearing aims to obtain a better understanding of why existing claims remain unresolved nearly 2 decades. After the head came law. What was the response from the department? Secondly, just a clarity. In your understanding, Commissioner, land claim or claim ahead compensation financial. Is the price of land the same as in rural area? What is your understanding there? Lastly, how many of your 9 findings are resolved up to now? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Actually, I wish to welcome this important and very informative presentation. Indeed, it's very, very exciting. I had a number of serious concerns, and I think I need to agree with Honorable Walters. You know, indeed, I guess, and continue to look at this in weeks and months to come as we are doing our work. I want to find out, I'm a bit concerned, starting point of the commission, it seems to be, even though it's coined as investigative hearings, it seems not to be hearings that involve the claimants. It seems that the commission penalizes its of moderator activities going respondents based on complaint that they have that the commissioner has been received for the periods of time. It would have been very, very useful, I would imagine, if claimants were there, if people were there, to indicate to the commission this is indeed our problem that we are experiencing. Not that I'm saying one is questioning or doubting the reference to complaints that they were received, but it would have given this whole process a holistic nature, and it would probably have elevated standing very, very substantially. But now it seems that only respondents were really engaged, not so much the ones who have the problem, who feel that their rights have been trampled upon. So I'm just a bit concerned as a human rights commission, one would have imagined that would have been the starting point, let's say. The other thing is that I'm not quite sure the presentation indicates, commissioner indicates that there seems to be a concern with regard to the LRAA that has become law now. In relation to existing claims, I'm not quite sure exactly what the issue is, what is the concern, whether it's just the reopening of the losments, whether the projection of 300 and nearly 400,000 new cases, whether that pose a serious threat for etc. Because I would imagine that the commission, given their interaction with the public, they would say no, we actually welcome this reopening of giving opportunities for new claims to be lost. Otherwise, if there are some other concerns that that the commission has, far from what I'm using it is, that the commission should in that respect share that with us, so that we indeed what we can be doing to address this process. But surely I certainly will welcome you.
The reason I'm lamenting the absence is that there is a
Commission, what you do is to make your findings and recommendations and take it that you then submit to the department. And then after the department decides what you do. Which leads me to a question pretty much similar to what my colleague from has put. Constitutionally, what is the department expected to do with your recommendations? Are there any timelines within which it has to do what it has to do? The issue, the two issues, one, of the long outstanding 1998 claims is something that we've raised time and time again with the department. And we don't seem to be getting any convincing satisfactory response from them as to how and when these claims will be finalized. Some of us have got paid to the report. Secondly, the issue of the budget, which you have pointed out to, or alluded to, we've also raised our concerns that as much as it is politically correct to reopen the claims, we, some of us, have got serious reservations as to the solvability of this actualizing itself, particularly given the trend that on so many occasions the land being claimed already either already has got some economic activity taking place, which means that there will not in all probability be a possibility, let me say, of actual restoration, and therefore financial compensation would be the viable option. Now, where is the cash to do that? This then makes the whole thing, the whole game, really political. And that's why we lament the fact that we don't have the political heads on this thing. Because the whole issue of land trade is a high political thing.
What I wanted to check out is that after this report, did you engage the department together with the commission and the findings of the report? I think my colleagues have just stayed away from the issue of the enforcement of the recommendation as a result. But what I wanted to also find out, are you able to initiate an investigation? Or maybe after you have received a request from individuals or from organizations that this concern that they are having, so they request human rights to investigate. Then the last one, I think is the issue of I was just looking at the people who have been consulted. To me, the report is based on the services that have been offered by the department to the people. But it is as Honorable Makele indicated, stakeholders which were consulted are the ones who provide the service. The receiver of the services seems as if they were not consulted. Can I get a guarantee?
Thank you, Chair. There was a flurry of questions that came from the floor here. We'll try and best to address them. Those that I cannot talk to, then I will refer those to the panel of the commissioners who sit on the commission, and we'll give a written report to the portfolio committee on it. I think that is fair. I'm not running away from any of the issues that you raised out here. I just want to basically say that when we did this investigation report, as the title indicates, it's monitoring and investigating the systemic challenges affecting the land restitution process in South Africa. Now, we want to know where were the bottlenecks and who was responsible for the bottleneck. How did it come about? And I think this is the overall theme behind the thing, because you know, it's easy, people can start playing the blaming game. It's X and Y and Z. So we said, no, let's go and address the root causes of the issue. And let's find the solution, the resolution of those, the thing, those mechanisms. So we thought that those five respondents that were there were basically key in resolving the land restitution problem in the first place. And therefore, that was the first point, port of call. To ask them, okay, here's the constitution, here's the legislation that's there, these are all the policies in place, what are the blockages? What we have found in the investigation report, which we'll go through again, is you will find that the report also speaks to a high turnover of staff, lack of technical expertise, and the report speaks to those issues. And the report also speaks to the issue of where the department said that they're taking hands. That's why I highlighted certain things in my report as well here, around the issue of the research, which underpins every claim out there. So there was that kind of latching on to research institutions like ULISA to look into those issues itself. I just want to talk about the issues from the first the first member there that spoke about restoration, redistribution, and the tenure of security versus the food security and those kind of issues. We just thought for now, for this report here, it was important to get to the underlying problems that are there to resolve the issues. I think those other issues that you raised here have been issues that have been debated in this OGAC House on the property rights and those kind of issues between the dispossessed and the people who are sitting with those properties, where there's that kind of tension. In relation to the values, in the value determination, the Constitutional Court has already ruled on that recently around the issue of what is the fair price. And that has assisted the Land Claims Commission to determine values on those principles. I think, from my perspective, what is very important, and that will give us, from the Commission's perspective, what will give some certainty and direction towards resolving the kind of issues that we've raised in the report itself, is that South Africa has ratified the International Covenant on Socio-Economic Rights. But to date, that was in 1994, to date we have not domesticated that into our own law. Hence, the result is that you're getting, every time a matter comes before a court of law, there's different interpretation on what certain things mean. So I think, in relation to us, the sooner we get to adopting that international covenant into our domestic law, we will get certainty in different ways to resolve the issues here. As I said, I was not part of this commission here. My briefing was just to come and talk to the issues here, and I'm not running away from the questions that are posed here. And I will indeed definitely take this question back home for us to interrogate them. Chair, I also want to say that the issue that you speak about, how binding is this report? It is in terms of the South African Human Rights Commission Act. Our terms of reference have been clearly stated out there. We present it to the Portfolio Committee. We present it to the National Assembly. And that's where the matter must be debated. And the decision must be taken there. Ours is not to do a witch hunt on anything with respect to the issues. Ours is to find solutions in the best interest of people who have been historically dispossessed of their rights. And we need to find those kind of solutions. And I think we will be doing our job if we present a report like this with conclusive findings in the way we think we can assist and engage the various stakeholders in trying to resolve the issues at hand. I think on the issue of communal the communal land and traditional leaders in impact of that as well. I raised that in my report as well, and the report itself speaks to those issues as well. And there are also those kind of tensions that perhaps needs to be resolved and looked into in a modest way. So in fact, the land claims court is also grappling with that issue itself. But I'm sure the commission itself will definitely go back to the drawing board to define the parameters of how to resolve those issues. I think from that perspective, what I want to also say is that we need to around the issue of the additional 400,000 claims that are there. We are saying that if there is a systematic approach to addressing the backlog, you will have enough rich historical content and precedent to find solutions for the 400,000 that are there or more in terms of the new act itself. I don't think there is a tension between the old act and the new act. It's just that those issues that came under the old act were not addressed within the time frame that was given. And hence the reopening doesn't mean it's opening up a floodgate to new claims. Every claim will be discussed on its own merits and debated. And the tensions that underlie those claims will be resolved according to its own merits. But then again, it speaks to the systemic issues that we were mandated to, in terms of our terms of reference in this report, to uncover. And we think we spoke a lot of that in, and I'll give you an example of that, when we asked from page 26, from the submission of the respondent itself, where they gave us the flow chart and everything, and to tell us this is how they envisage to see how these things are implemented. Now, the question is, did we give them an opportunity to discuss this matter? We thought, when we did our findings here, it was important to engage with them at one level. But it was also, just given that 2014 has been a bit of a, we had two elections, so we had the last parliament and the new parliament as well. We thought it was our duty also to come and brief the portfolio committee here on the issues, and then these reports don't sit in somebody's office until a matter is brought to the fore. So we thought it was important for us to engage with you, but we have also given these reports to the various departments that respond. I think in terms of the principles of national justice, it is very important that they were given a copy of this report to respond to. And we will definitely engage them. We have said that beyond this, we are going to monitor the progress from here, that now that we found the problem areas. The question of the budget and the reopening of claims, I don't think things exist in a vacuum. So, obviously these have budgetary implications accordingly. But there are principles set in place on how to resolve these kind of issues. So, that's for Parliament to analyze at another level and come up with a solution. But ours, the Human Rights Commission, is to say that, look, the Restitution of Land Act has certain principles to address certain issues. And we are worried because we are concerned that those issues that were raised did not address those problems. And then by reopening the new chapter on land restitution in the thing, may create the collapse of the institution itself. And that is our concern. So what we are saying is, in the interim constitution check, what is very important is that the Commission on Restitution of Land Rights was an independent body. It was not subsumed under a unit of the Department of Government. And I think this is the tension that needs to be resolved as a matter of urgency. Although we are speaking to the Constitution and the principles of the Constitution, but I think the Land Commission must be given that space to work through the issues that they were mandated to in the first place. The principles are the same in terms of the Act. people who disobey, the law is very clear. Where the land is still in the hands of the state today, and the person who has been disobeyed wants restitution of the land, the choice must be his or her. It mustn't be the other. Where the land is in the hands of the state, and the person wants compensation, that is a choice they make. Where the land was taken away from the people, and the state then built something on it, or sold it to a third party, then obviously the principles are very simple. You either give alternative land, or you give compensation, or you come to some kind of dispensation by the state. So those are the issues that we basically had to bring to your attention, Chair. And as I said, in the end, what we're going to do from here, the report is not an end in itself. It is going to, we're going to have a monitoring and evaluation process where we're going to then knock on the doors of the various respondents to give them those time frames and ask them for reports. In fact, those are reports that we have to table before the committee as well. In relation to the question that the chair, the first, the honourable member asked on the other side, is why is it that the commission only focuses on one group and not the other group? The principle, the problem is that the answer is, it's not a straightforward answer, but I think in a, if I can simplify it, is to say that there are claimants waiting for the claims to be resolved. They are not the problem. The problem is, why is the state not addressing the issue? And who in the state is not addressing the issue? And this is where we knocked on the doors of the five respondents that we got, were critical key holders, stakeholders in the process. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think
prefer not to be less emphatic. Sorry. to measure impact on that aspect. It's clear that land was forcefully taken away from the people who occupied the land before. Save for those that happened after 1906 or 1913 rather. But generally, through and through, the people at the date of arrival, which was 1652, in three ships, they forcefully took away, in 1652, 6th of April, forcefully took away land. Let this be clear. Let this be clear. And so I would say, for noting or even for the honorable Abdul Mohammed's comment, that it becomes even more difficult when you have a property clause, which we own, that would then protect such land. It protects such land, it protects property in general, and you seek to compensate and restitute. The better now falls onto the state. The better now goes to the state to restitute and to emancipate what those people had lost. But they had not lost to the state, they had lost to the colonizer. And to the extent that my forefather can say my home was here, my homestead was here, it should have been easy, but Section 25 is an issue. EFF is not here. EFF is here. But clearly that's one issue on which they give us food for thought in a very issue. I just wanted to check the commissioner. I have a question. Where, one way or the other, a wrong, the people can allow us to do this, but a wrong community benefits out of a claim. And I say a wrong community, if it were to be proven later that, oh, it was a mistake. Maybe not enough research, or the other four people were not here. What is their record? I had asked this from the department. The department said, then people can appeal right through the constitution. But it's money all the way, which communities would not have. So in your view, do you have an answer now as to what can a community do, you know, that the ones that feel that they are the real people, wrong people, were actually allocated there, exactly. And last with the issue of budget, that can there be a definite timeline that by such and such a time would have been done with the restitution and claims, regardless of the budget, because part of the process now is to compensate financially, and the budget is within the overall national system. So those are just the two main questions. Thank you.
Changing of strategy and tactics by the white minority government to things and the books. And that we are not going to be very patient or try to be very nice when we deal with the issues. People died over very many years. I don't even want to talk about the Kony and the Sun. Because if we are to do that, then we'll need an international court, you know, to settle this issue. Because we're talking about extermination of whole communities through laws and guns and sicknesses. Very, very cruel thing that happens in this country, Congress. But it's just that we're not saying them very, very loudly. But when people who have their land in their hands start talking like they own it in our minds, it's very wrong. Because one day, the world is going to turn in this country. Worms are seen as very harmful creatures, but when you provoke it like with a stick all the time, provoke with a stick, it turns around and tries to bite the stick, even though it knows that it doesn't exist. It just hopes that maybe by the grace of the Holy Spirit, this person who's tormenting me may end up changing their mind. I don't want to preach to this. This is not a congregation, I'm just saying that, you know, this thing actually raises a lot of things in all of us. It seriously raises the animal in all of us. People die. There are those who are still alive, but they are wrecked, you know, damaged both mentally and physically. Some of us fought in this war. Not just talking stories among and whatever. I'm talking about people who are carrying guns, and some of those people are in this parliament now. Still damaged and endless. So I just wanna go just leave this whole thing and go back to your presentation, and I want to understand more about this convention. And that this convention you're talking, the international convention you're talking about, what value will it add to our processes now? Yes. And then if you say it was ratified by South Africa, then it means if you ratify this convention without aligning the laws, then it means to actually contravene the convention if we have done that. Because part of conventions, like you can talk about the convention on the prisoners of war. The MK actually took that convention very, very seriously. When we captured people who were seen as the enemy, wearing enemy uniforms, we treated them like soldiers. We never treat them like criminals who came to infiltrate the organization and conspire as well. But when captured by the enemy, we were treated like criminals, soldiers, and all those. So I want to know that, because when you sign a convention and then your laws are not aligned, then you are contravening internationally. You know? So I just want to know, when was it ratified by South Africa? And why did we ratify it without aligning our laws? We have done that with the many international conventions in this parliament, like the ILO. There were certain conventions that were sponsored by South Africa, but it took South Africa nearly 2 years to sign those conventions, even though they were drawn by us. But it's because you cannot sign on the dotted line if you are not aligned, you know, if your laws are not in line with the spirit and the intention of the convention. Let us give you that.
Thank you, Chair. I'm concerned with the presentation in front of us. One of the issues that comes up for me is the resourcing issue of land claims, and what you raised previously in the committee there, I think that to the extent to which that is an obstacle. deals with the independence of the various bodies. You mentioned that the Lankers Commission itself seems to be subsumed bureaucratically, which seems to be a systemic problem there. I think that's a source of serious concern, and I think you're going to a committee report in this regard. It's clearly a bottleneck or a constraint that you refer to. And then also the issue of process management from the beginning to the end, from the claim being lodged, evidence being collected, right to the claim being settled. I'm not clear. The possibility towards the Human Rights Commission isn't, you're not process engineers. You're not industrial engineers, if I can put it that way. But it would be very interesting, and I wonder whether it's possible to have a process expert actually looking at the entire claims process from beginning to end and see what the bottlenecks or what the constraints are that can be dealt with. I think that might be very helpful in both saving resources as well as getting justice to our citizens. And I think another aspect that came out in the report that I think is a very important point for us to take on board is that it's redress is not. It means that whatever you get out of it, you need to be able to dispose of. You need to be able to have an economic future around it. That it's not just about giving property back to people; it's also giving means back, control over the future back. And I think that's important. Don't put good words in your mouth, but I think that's an important concept that maybe with my own bias reading, obviously, and my own way of looking at things, that comes out in this report. And I would like to put that down as a point. Now, I was missing Member Kutama. I'm glad to see that there's people that are following these acts here in this committee. And I just think it needs to be stated that all of us in this committee are dedicated to really restoring, normalizing South Africa, creating a just society, dealing with the inequities and the injustices of the past. But I think there's a big, fine line between saying farmers to go all thieves, which is not the case. The legal owners of land, whether it was based on an unjust history or not, that's what we are trying to fix. But if you label entire communities as thieves and stolen land and oppressors, without thinking, and this is what justice is all about, individual justice, without having a process that both look at the legitimate interests of a farming community as well as the legitimate interests of the historical oppressed, and finding the way forward as a society, so that they're not going to go anywhere. Let's not have comments bordering on hate speech to distract attention from the failure of government in the past 20 years to deal with us. So this is what we have to do. Let's fix the problems and move forward. Thanks.
What I'm saying is that, honorable.
will respond if you want to respond. But this is not the first and the last. That is what you must remember. This was the presentation. As the committee, we have to take this matter forward because we are going to have meetings with the commission. So for now, can you assist me based your question and the presentation that has been made? Then we'll take the matter forward together with the department and the commission.
I think it's wrong timing. You're supposed to do that before I spoke. It's a wrong timing. Honestly now. I feel we should start there. You're supposed to start there when they started commenting. And they must ask the next question. Because I'm doing my comment and I'll ask questions later. Let's comment it. Let's send other messages which I don't understand. Now I must comment there because give me an opportunity to look at each one allowed there. I must speak.
Can you speak?
Thank you.
Yes.
What I'm trying to say, there's no there's no foolish question in this committee. Why I'm saying that, what I wanted to find out is, human rights commissioner like Chulima Tonsela's commissioner, in the sense that I've asked, is it binding and what are they binding or not? Now there were comments which think other people, they don't know exactly what are they speaking about. That was the third question, wanted the third response. Nonetheless, my oversight work, I feel which is actually here undermined. In a sense, yes, they are saying there's an honorable Southgate who's here, who's representing the department, and there's, if I'm not mistaken, deputy commissioner. I know him. Maybe directly for us to have an effective oversight, this question that we're asking, maybe they can respond. Because it's now 12 months, this report, there's no feedback, according to, you cannot say the way they should understand. But this report has been to, fortunately, because you are here, to not have the hour of this report. Can you get a feedback on this issue? Thank you.
Money to send more. you don't have a huge delegation. That's what the seniors should be part and listen to the presentation. Meaning that today, I will just give them a short time to comment, because we're still going to have a meeting with them. And if you have been listening well, some of the findings of the commission were part of our report. Those are the challenges, some of the challenges, the challenges that were also identified as the committee in our report. So I'm going to give advocate to comment where he wants to comment, and also the commission, and Mr. Southgate to just close the meeting. But we're still going to have time, because we need to go through the report ourselves and get some of the information, so that while we proceed with the restitution, at least we understand the details of the report. Another challenge before the advocate.
The report, like you said, as a committee, we can engage with this report, and we're just getting issues of clarity on other things, so that when we debate or when we discuss this matter, you may not be around to answer some of the questions. But I must say, Sir President, that you know the saying that if you have tendency of teaching us, and then other people have the capacity to keep more dust than you do, you'll end up suffocating in that dust, and no one is going to help you. My attitude has changed because of the changing in the situation in this in this moment. We have been.
Can I just request you to just end this? I think we'll finalize the comments, the questions, and all of that. Can I just take this opportunity and give it to the advocate, to the commission, and also to the public? It seems as if we're too emotional today. Why?
I know it wants to rule over the
majority. I've given the advocate and the deputy commissioner and also Mr. Southgate to comment on the issues that have been raised. Let it be so. I'm still the chair, and I need to be respected. How about you, advocate?
Sure, before that. So there's an honourable member that said she's commenting, and these are things which are just in part of themselves. You know, now and then, this gentleman, I don't know, he's maybe an honourable member, but I'm asking, I don't know how to change how this honourable gentleman, he's only commenting, or he's part of us, you know, discuss with us, you know, very differently.
No, the problem that is, the parliament activities are open to the public, but they must not comment. They must just become observers. So I didn't hear anything. If maybe they want the comment, I think can it be just of the, we just observe as a guest, we don't comment. The people who are participating are members, and also those people who have been invited to make presentations. Advocate, over to you.
Madam Chair, thank you. To the extent that this question is directed to me, I will attempt to answer this question, and then the fellow commissioners, fellow police can answer the other questions that they deem fit for you. Let me start off by saying that the wrong entitlement issue. The first question that came from one of the members there. And I'm saying that inasmuch as we must understand we are a constitutional democracy. So inasmuch as a person is aggrieved and we're looking at the constitutional court that has a role to play in this matter, the Inkunti matter makes it very clear that no community will be deprived of legal representation. So those communities can engage legal representation via the legal aid board and then can access their justice at that level. In relation to budget, the issue is very clear. Socio-economic rights are progressively supposed to be realized.
Chair, I see an election from the media. There's a teacher that are promising that take us to assistance. There's a lot for guests to take pictures here.
No, if there was a picture taken, I think it's wrong.
Okay.
In this committee room, there would be no person that would be allowed to take pictures. But if there was no picture taken,
so that you can realize the objectives of the Constitution. That's all we are saying. Now, we are saying is we do not know why, but in 1994 we ratified it, and I think there was a conscious decision to ratify it, and it wasn't something just to get an international status highlighted. But the idea was that we wanted to address the backlog of this country quickly and as speedily as possible. And that is the reason why we need to do the to domesticate that into our state. Again, that is dependent, again, on the progressive realization of socio-economic rights. The issue then around the honourable member that spoke about the resources and that was an opinion around land and the obstacles around it. I think from page 45 to page 47 in my report, in our report, we speak to those issues. Perhaps this committee needs to deliberate and come back to us on that. In relation to the bottleneck, this is exactly what we, the terms of reference that was given to us to investigate and put a report together to find out where, how we can help resolve the issues. And then, obviously, the question of a single claim and a double claim and a triple claim, in a way, the honorable member has said we move from point A to point B to point C. My understanding of the restitution of land act is that where there is a claim and where you've been dispossessed because of those claim and the defective, each claim will be addressed separately. So I don't think there's a conflict. The issue around selling of this thing is another issue there, and that requires another level. So I think I have addressed the issues adequately. Thank you.
Sure that when considering these plans, we check whether it's
think would be, has been an eye-opener to the commission, and they are preparing for the second lottery, because the challenges that have been identified in the first phase must be addressed to make sure that when dealing with the second phase, they don't experience the same challenges. So challenges, if you are working, the challenges will be there, but challenges must not be there forever. We need to develop a plan on how to deal with those challenges so that we can move forward. The other thing that we need to know is that the end of the session is not an event, it's a process.